Cheers. We have great love and respect for Brother Gary Summers and his good wife Barbara. They got to know him and her really back in first in 1996 in the old Denton lectures. And over the years, after moving to Roanoke, Texas, we got to be a lot closer to them and with them, and learn to respect him and his intellect, his ability, and the great work he does, the writing. He is a great gospel preacher, and he has a great wife to support him. We love and appreciate the good work that you brethren are doing here, and we stay up on it through the bulletin. I appreciate getting the bulletin and the various works you're involved in, and the efforts not only here but also around the world. Your faith to Godward is spoken of. We appreciate you in so many different ways. My title or my lesson this morning is on the basis of morality. And as a beginning point, I'd like for you to look at Matthew chapter 21 and verse 25, where Jesus really hones in on the central issue of authority. The baptism of John, whence was it? From heaven or of men? With this question, Jesus gets to the heart of really every issue, not only in morality, but also in religion. And that has to do with the matter of authority. While the questions center on the positive divine command from John the Baptist to the Jewish people to be baptized, yet nonetheless frame the issue of authority for all things in religion and morality. In logic, we would call this a strong disjunctive or a bifurcation that offers but two possibilities and only those possibilities. When you think about this particular subject before us, as with so many things, the basis of morality is either from inside the subject and therefore is subjective, or it is from outside the subject, that is outside of the mind, and is objective. There's no middle ground between the two. Subjectivity or objectivity. Getting back to the question that Jesus asked concerning the baptism of John, whence was it? From heaven? That's objective truth. Did God give it? Is it outside of your mind, that is the mind of the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and so on? Was this command originated from the mind of someone higher and greater than you? From a source that is of greater authority than you? Or did it arise, or did this command come from another human being, and therefore is a subjective command? You see, subjectivity has to do with the inside of the mind of the subject. Well, who's the subject? We are. You and I. Whereas objectivity has to do with a standard and with an origin that transcends our human minds, that transcends who we are, what we think, how we feel, our wishes, our whims, and our caprices. Whereas subjectivity is bound up in all of those things. How we feel, what we think about things. We need to also recognize at the outset the basic nature of morality itself. Morals has to do, by definition and from its root origin, with our relationship to others, including ourselves, to other human beings. That's its primary connection. Religion has to do primarily with our relationship to deity. Now, the two are interrelated, as James 1:27 clearly indicates. Pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this, that a man must visit the widows, the fatherless and the widows in their affliction, and keep himself unspotted from the world. And so pure religion, in its proper length and breadth and depth, also includes a proper relationship and treatment of those about us. In this case, James 1:27, orphans and widows are under consideration, or those who are fatherless, bereft of parental care. And so we cannot be in a good relationship or right relationship with God and yet maintain evil, ungodly relationships with those that are about us. And vice versa. In fact, 1 John chapter 5, 1 and 2, down through verse 3 shows that to be the case. Verse 3 tells us, "For this is the love of God, that we do what? Keep his commandments." Well, if you back up verses 1 and 2, you find that one of the commandments is that we love one another. And so in order for us to have a relationship where we properly love God, we have to love one another as well. When Jesus was asked in Matthew chapter 22, what is the great commandment? He actually gave two. He said, the first is, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy soul, mind, and strength. In a parallel, he says, soul, mind, heart, and strength. And he says, the second is like unto the first. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Now watch this, verse 40. He says, upon these two commandments, hangeth all the law and the prophets. Alexander Campbell, in noting this particular passage, made this observation. He said that all truly beneficial laws, particularly in the Western world, have historically recognized these two basic principles, that man must have a right standing with God first and foremost, following a right standing with one another. That the two go hand in hand, that we must have that in order to have a truly beneficial legal system and a system of laws that reflect these two great principles. They summarize the very nature of what the law and the prophets were about. And when we come over to Romans 13, we find the Apostle Paul concerning the law of Jesus Christ making a similar point when he says that that love is the fulfilling of the law. Why? Because it works no ill against its neighbor. For us to properly love one another is, by definition, to have a proper respect and regard for that individual, not only to their intrinsic value, but a concern that causes us or leads us to do those things that are in their best interest. That may even require rebuke, very strong rebuke from time to time. It may require, in the case of brethren, practicing church discipline, as in 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 6, and other passages. But the point is this, the grounding principle is love in this regard and a proper understanding of what that love entails. Love is not to be confused with a mushy, gray type of let's just go along to get along. Let's just tolerate anything and everything. That's not love. God so loved us that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth, keeps on believing in him, should not perish, but have everlasting life. But notice, it's conditional. That is, that if we're not to perish, it's conditional. Well, what if we don't believe on Christ? If we refuse to obey him? If we refuse to serve him? Then the implication is, despite the love of God, we're going to perish. We're going to be destroyed. And that's the force of the text. So we must recognize what morality is, what it entails, its relationship to religion, and how both are intertwined together and dependent upon one another. They stand and fall together. And so when you really get down to it, and I could say this right now, the basis of morality is God. When you get down to it, the basis of morality is God. God is the originator of all truly beneficial laws that have governed the world since time began. Amen. He originated the patriarchal laws, gave them to the heads of the households in order to govern their families and lead them in the right way. He gave the law of Moses to the Hebrew children, to the Hebrew people, for that same basic purpose, to guide them, to govern them, until the seed, Jesus Christ, should come. In fact, the law, Paul says in Galatians 3:24, was our paidagogos, our child leader, the slave that is sent out to take the child in hand, guide him through life until he comes of age, and then takes him down the street to the home of the great teacher and turns him over to that teacher for training and learning. Well, Jesus Christ is that great teacher. The law of Moses was to the Hebrew children what that slave was to the well-to-do Hebrew child, particularly a boy child. And Paul uses that imagery to show it had a relationship, to guide, to guard, to direct the Hebrew people in the way they should go. It was no wonder that David would say of that law in Psalm 119, verse 11, and the principle still stands, the basic underlying idea, "Thy word have I hid in my heart that I might not sin against thee." What is he talking about? Putting God's word in his life. Well, where'd that word come from? It's thy word. God is the originator of it. And then, of course, we have the New Testament, which was given by Jesus Christ, and which provides all things pertaining unto life and godliness. 2 Peter chapter 1, verses 3 and 4. Many other passages can be cited along this line. How God has provided for us through the Scriptures to guide us in the way that we should go. And so He is the basis of morality, has always been the basis of morality. Under patriarchy, under the Mosaic dispensation, and today under the Christian dispensation or the gospel age. He is the originator of it. And so from the outset, and my lecture could be done at this point, from the outset, we need to know that He is the objective source of the standard by which we live and die today in His sight. In fact, in Him we live and move and have our being. Acts 17, verse 28. We are totally dependent on Him. Even the most vile person you can imagine, even the most rapacious atheist who says, I don't have to listen, he is still answerable to God and he is still dependent on Him. One of the most absurd things I've ever heard a human being say is, I don't need God. We don't need God. Reminded me of Brother John Henry Clay's response I've used numerous times over the years. Brother Clay heard a man say that one time. Well, Brother Clay says, well, then, sir, stop breathing God's air. You didn't make it. God made it. Stop walking on His grass. Stop enjoying His skies. Stop looking at the beauty of His world. Stop eating the food that He made if you think you don't need God. The problem we're faced with right now in our nation is we have forgotten that basic principle. That's what's happened. And the reason is we have adopted a view that says that morality arises from within the individual. Now, we may qualify that and say, well, not from one individual alone, from a group of individuals coming together and forming and shaping and coming to some sort of consensus, but it still winds up being from the same source, from the mind, the feelings, the thoughts, the whims and caprices of an individual or group of individuals. It's still subjective in nature. That's what it winds up being. Wish I had time to discuss our sense of oughtness. We all have a sense of oughtness. We're born with it. It is part of our innate nature. That sense of oughtness holds that we should do what is right, whatever it is. We may not understand what is right, may not know, especially when we're real little. We have to learn the difference between good and evil. But we all have it. Even atheists have it. We need to understand the difference between subjective-based morality and objective-based. Now, according to subjectivism, the moral values of each person are autonomous and equal. Now, think about that. While some may say, well, I'm not talking about the individual, I'm talking about a group of individuals. Really, their doctrine will not even allow that. Because who is to say that a group of individuals' feelings are any more important than one other person's feelings on that basis? In other words, is it a matter of counting heads? What about 11 people as opposed to 10? If we have a group of 11 and they say it's all right to murder people and 10 say that it's wrong to murder, are the 11 more right than the 10 who say it's wrong? Does it become a matter of counting heads to determine who is right and who is wrong? Ultimately, subjectivism says that the individual is the ultimate determiner of what is right and wrong, period. And as a result, what you will find, and if you read the manuscript, if we don't get to this point, you need to read it. Ultimately, this leads to the conclusion that individuals are not responsible for their own decisions. Because after all, according to the system that involves subjectivism, the underlying philosophy holds that there is no real free will anyway. You ever wondered why there are some judges who will take an individual who has raped and raped and raped and raped another individual multiple times, in fact 30, 40, 50 times over the years? He comes before the judge and the judge gives him probation or maybe 30 days in jail with probation because the judge doesn't believe he's responsible for what he's done. There are many judges that hold that view, brethren. In fact, there is a particular group of judges who advocate no punishment at all. But what they talk about is we're going to redeem these people in the humanistic sense. And that's their idea, that's their plan. That somehow we're going to reform them from doing these things without punishing them, without holding them to account. And that philosophy is very prevalent in the judicial community. And we need to understand that's part of the battle we're fighting. That's what we're dealing with in this nation right now. You ever heard these expressions? Don't judge me. What's that say? I have a right to make up my mind, and whatever I say is good for me. And you have no basis to tell me it's wrong. That's the idea. And some of them will even try to use the words of Jesus to justify that doctrine. They'll misapply Matthew 7, verse 1 and 2. They will ignore the context of that statement, and they will ignore what Jesus said elsewhere about when ye judge righteous judgment. They'll ignore all other passages. You ever heard this one? True for you, but not for me. Oh, it's true for you. I know you're against homosexuality. That's the truth for you. But me, I believe I have a right to believe it's all right. Never mind what Paul says. Never mind what the New Testament teaches. It's all a matter of what I think. That's not my reality. You ever had someone say that? That's not my... That we make our own reality. I actually heard a professor say that. We make our own reality. I think I told you about young man who wasn't paying his income taxes for several years. I believe R.C. Sproul is the one who records this in his book, Not a Chance. And this young man was brought in for an audit And the auditor of the IRS asked him, he says, why haven't you filed your income taxes for the last several years? And the young man says, well, when I was in college, I learned from my philosophy professor that we create our own reality. And to me, paying income taxes just wasn't important. Well, the IRS agent thought for a little bit, and he then responded. He says, well, young man, when you're sitting in your 5x10 cell, just imagine you're on a beach somewhere. Remake your reality. But there are people that believe they create their own reality. That somehow their mind magically changes even matter itself. And refashions it. You might call that the Star Trek view of life or something. Anyway, you ever heard this? Follow your bliss. Do what makes you happy, in other words. Follow your bliss is a phrase that Joseph Campbell came up with, and no relation to Alexander Campbell, by the way. Joseph was an atheist. And by the way, a lot of the Hollywood nonsense that comes out poking fun at Christianity comes from people influenced by Joseph Campbell. One of them is a young man that we used to know as O.P. Taylor. Some of the stuff he's put out has been implicitly to make a dig at Christianity or certain aspects of Christian doctrine over the year, and to promote New Age religion. Well, Joseph Campbell was a New Age guru to a certain extent. He was a humanist. He was an atheist. And his philosophy was, follow your bliss. Do what makes you happy. In other words, if it makes you happy, it's good. If it doesn't make you happy, it's evil. Well, what about John Wayne Gacy? What was his bliss? You ever thought about that? If people follow their bliss, other people get hurt. What may make you happy may make someone very unhappy. In fact, it may make them dead. And the Nazis followed their bliss, and they killed 6 million Jews and another 4 million other people. Over 10 million people perished at the hands of the Nazis following their bliss. Get in touch with your inner feelings, or your inner self, or your inner child. These are just different ways of saying the same thing. And by getting in touch with your inner child, it's do what is selfish, self-centered. Because children, by nature, when they're real little, they don't understand the need to share. You have to teach them. There is a selfishness in little children. That's mine. 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 You can't have that. That's mine. That's a child. Well, get in touch with your inner child. And this is the basis, by the way, of much of humanist psychology, particularly Gestalt therapy and that type of nonsense. But subjective-based morality leads to this kind of thing. We need to also recognize the underlying philosophy for the humanist ethos is philosophical naturalism, and there's a lengthy discussion of what is involved in philosophical naturalism. Philosophical naturalism is basically the philosophy, and it is a philosophy of life. By the way, every human being is a philosopher. Do you know that? You have a personal philosophy. Now, whether your philosophy accords with the philosophy of God, accords with the Bible, if your worldview is that which God has of the world, that Jesus Christ is taught concerning the world, that's where it ought to be. That may be your philosophy. But everyone has a philosophy. You have an understanding or an idea or a thought. It may not be completely thought out or in sort of a rational way, reason through. You may have some kind of concept as to the way things are supposed to work in your eyes. you have a philosophy. And the vast majority of philosophies are all designed to justify what we do. And that's true of humanist philosophies especially. Whether you go back all the way back to Socrates and Confucius and Aristotle and Plato and come all the way up through Anselm and various others and to the time of Thomas Hobbes and David Hume and Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Voltaire and then the German philosopher Schopenhauer and Goethe, right on up through Nietzsche and to the present day, or more present times, such as Heidegger and men like Gadamer. All of these philosophies are designed, everything these guys put out was designed to justify especially what they themselves wanted to do, believe, and practice. They always made themselves look good because they were living in keeping with the philosophy they thought was best for the whole human race. And that just happened to coincide with the way in which they were living their own life. Human philosophy set up that way. In fact, if you ever can get your hands on it, Brother Thomas B. Warren's discussion of Romans chapter 1 is eye-opening, especially against the backdrop of philosophy, the study of philosophy. Because in Romans 1, as Warren points out, Paul shows that at one time the human race knew there was but one God. But they rejected that knowledge. They forgot it. And they did so because they wanted to worship themselves and they wanted to worship other things to justify their own behavior. As Brother Warren said, they wanted a God that would not talk back. They wanted gods and goddesses that practiced the same evil things they practiced. They told lies, they fornicated, and they murdered people, and they robbed and stole from other people, just like the human beings did. And especially themselves. And you go through Romans 1 and you notice the progression of the sins of the Gentiles, including their sexual mores and their sexual behavior. And how God gave them up. In fact, it says three times in Romans 1, God gave them up to a reprobate mind. The root meaning of that word translated reprobate is the mind of a dog. Dogs will do some disgusting things. But what they do because they have no moral nature. They're amoral. We are supposed to have moral natures. We have the ability, despite what atheists claim, we have the ability to choose to do good, to choose to do evil. We have the ability to make a practice of that which is right and proper, to treat people in a right way, and to control ourselves, to behave as we ought to behave. Unfortunately, the vast majority of us make a practice of constantly violating God's law. Rejecting the moral obligations that we have and treating people just as we please. That's what we do. At any event, we have that ability. But in doing so, what happens is an individual who gives himself so totally over to just doing what pleases himself becomes amoral. Not just immoral, he goes beyond that. He's no longer an immoral person. He is amoral. He feels he has no obligations or anything else impending on him. Nothing else governs his life. Philosophical naturalism is the basis of these humanistic ideas, the human-centered philosophies. What the one thing that Hobbes and Hume and all of these other philosophers had in common is this: philosophical naturalism. Man is simply matter in motion. We are hairless apes, as Desmond Morris described us. That's their idea. And so they also believe in materialism. All there is matter. Then on top of that, they believe in determinism. If all there is matter, then matter determines whatever happens. Your thoughts, even your thoughts, and I've got the documentation here from numerous atheists. In fact, yesterday, I was in a bookstore, surprise, surprise. I was in a bookstore, Barnes & Noble, and looking at a book by Dr. Victor Stanger. And the book is entitled, and this also plays into the arrogance of the atheist and the fact that they believe themselves to be so brilliant, despite the fact, by the way, God says you're a fool if you're an atheist. Psalm 14:1, the fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. Brother Keeble used to say, he'd quote that passage, said, put it down, if God calls you a fool, you're a fool, with a capital F. At any event, the atheist thinks he's brilliant. But the title of the book is God and the Folly of Faith. He also wrote a book entitled God, the Failed Hypothesis. But in four pages, pages 269 to 272, he in effect undoes his entire argument against the existence of God. In that chapter of only four pages, he deals with a matter of free will. And he says free will is an illusion. Doesn't really exist. Well, why would you write a book of 400 pages to try to persuade somebody you need to change your mind about believing in God if they can't change their mind? That is, as one professor used to say, Brother Deaver used to say in class, he said, that is just purely asinine. That's exactly what it is. Absurd. Ridiculous. But that's where they are. He wrote an entire book attacking the existence of God and then turns around and says, well, you believe what you believe because the biochemical processes in your brain and the happenstance of evolution makes you believe it. Well, if you believe in the existence of God, then you do so because you had no choice. And if you don't believe in the existence of God, you do so because you had no choice. That's the implication of that. And if that is so, then why write books to try to argue people to change the biochemical processes in their brain? You're saying you have no control over that. And yet, you can't choose to change it. Yet, here's a book that says you're a fool if you don't. That's nonsense. Yeah, Brother Wayne Coates, who earned his doctorate, by the way, at Vanderbilt. And he studied under a lot of these philosophers and he took them to task. And Brother Warren earned his doctorate at Vanderbilt. Brother Coates would say, that doesn't even make good nonsense. But that's determinism. And then finally, there's nihilism. Nihilism in subjectivity is there is no real purpose to anything. And this is what I want to close out on. This view that there is no real purpose to anything leads people to despair. It causes people to just give up. You think about some of the statements that are made. Just look at statements sometimes that atheists have made when they were dying. And it'll chill your blood at times as they were facing death. But nihilism really is destructive, very destructive to human beings. We have to have a positive view of life in order to function properly. Colonel Robert Ingersoll, often called the great skeptic, by the way, he's no longer a skeptic now. My time's up. But I want to read this statement. Life is a narrow veil. He said this at the graveside of his own brother. Life is a narrow veil between the cold and barren peaks of two eternities. We strive in vain to look beyond the heights. We cry aloud. And the only answer is the echo of our wailing cry. From the voiceless lips of the unreplying dead, there comes no word. But in the night of death, hope sees a star. And listening love can hear the rustle of a wing. What's he saying? Well, we hope there's something beyond this life. But we really have no real solid evidence of anything like that. We hope against hope. What a difference between that and Paul's statement. I have fought the good fight. I have finished my course. I've kept the faith. Henceforth there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give me in that day, and not to me only, but unto all them that love his appearing. What a difference. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Brother Denham for that excellent presentation. There's so much more material, obviously, in the book. And let me just mention concerning the book, since it's a lot bigger this year and has 98 pages and cost of everything has gone up, we're asking for $5. But if you want to pay last year's price, we'll take it. and in fact, if you haven't got the money, just take a book anyway, because we really want the material to get out.